Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 89. On this episode of the podcast, we are talking about Brooklyn, a smaller film that you may not have seen, but maybe you are hearing about now. Despite its small nature, it is getting a lot of notoriety through the award season, which we all think is very deserved. And to help me talk about it is Elijah Lovejoy and Blaine Grimes, two guys who really enjoyed this film, along with myself. So we're probably going to have a conversation worthy of this film in its small yet noteworthy way. Now that I've been redundant, let me just remind you guys to go to realworldtheology.com to check out all our new content, check out our new podcast that's starting up that Blaine will be hosting. You can find reviews, follow us on Twitter, follow us on Facebook, subscribe to the podcast, rate and review the show, and just let's keep that conversation going, guys. For now, we do have a really great show for you. So here it is, episode 89, Brooklyn and Finding Home.
Blaine, just in like a one or two sentence synopsis, what's your movie angle or background? I know your name and that's it. So I'd love to hear kind of where you're coming from. I know you're into film.
Yeah. So I just recently got my MA in English, and I concentrated on film and media studies, and I hope to teach that someday. So That's kind of my thing.
And do you do a podcast or a review site, or what do you do publicly with movies currently, if anything?
Oh, good. So, yeah, I write.
How convenient of a question.
That's a great question. I write reviews at Real World Theology. I've written some stuff for Christ and Pop Culture. And I am actually starting a new podcast pretty soon with Real World Theology, and there'll be more on that to come in the future.
In the coming weeks?
Nice.
Actually, it's very interesting. I'm not sure when this podcast is going to air, because this is part of my pre-pregnancy planning podcasts. So the PP.
Nice.
PP.
That was nice peas there, yep. Yeah.
Pre-pregnancy planning. Podcast, the pre-pregnancy planning podcast.
Ooh, I like it. So quadruple alliteration.
Yeah, this is the alliterative podcast. So this is going to be one of those podcasts that I know Brooklyn is going to be nominated for something. Like, it seems.
How do you think
at this point, with the amount of nominations that Brooklyn has got, it seems odd that it would not get something. Like, you know, not maybe Best Picture. You know, maybe it's not got enough push for something like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, maybe a Best Actress nod or something. Cinematography. You know, it's a beautiful film. There's lots of great things that we can say about it. But it seems like there would be something. Mm-hmm. And so I'm pretty sure once the Oscars announcements are put out, I think on January 14th, that this movie will be called, again, for something.
So you're gonna time this so that you can release the podcast as interest, hopefully, in the film is
kind of peaking,
cresting.
Because it's a smaller film. Mm-hmm. and this happens typically every year. We ended up not releasing some of the films that got nominated for awards for Oscars until after the Oscar nominations were out. And that some of that was kind of planned, some of that was just kind of how the films came out. You know, so we ended up doing things like Birdman and Whiplash kind of like right before the actual Oscar show.
Right.
So since we're supposed to have a child first week of February, and I'll probably be a little tied up, but I don't want to be behind on the podcast.
Yeah.
There's a good chance that whole month of February where we're kind of sitting and stewing on who's going to win the Oscar for this, what's going to win the Oscar for this. We're going to have a couple shows on movies like this that should this not get nominated for any Oscars, we can put it out at least with the idea that it should have, probably for something, and we'll probably get into the reasons for that. But kind of transitioning, I guess, more into talk about Brooklyn, I would ask you guys this, because this is kind of what I was curious about. We've already pointed out this is not a huge blockbuster. This is not even really like that big of a film, and it didn't get a lot of advertisement. It didn't get a lot of studio push. I mean, it got some studio push, but, you know, since it's like a Fox Searchlight, I believe. So for that type of film, it got some push. But it's not like it was in every theater. You couldn't miss it. There was posters for it everywhere. So, you know, simple or smaller films like this almost always end up flying completely under the radar, even during what we're talking about this upcoming award season. So how did you come across it? Kind of what made you take a chance to see it, you know, kind of like what drew you to it? And Blaine, I'll start with you since you were not in studio.
Sure. I think I saw a trailer when I was going to see some, I think it may have been when I was seeing Suffragette. I saw the trailer, and I had heard a couple of things about it before, but hadn't really sat down and actually watched the trailer or read anything about it. Saw the trailer, looked really interesting, and I think that's how I heard about it.
So what was it about it that you said, okay, well, that was a trailer. Why would you want to pay money to go back and see another small movie?
So I've kind of always been obsessed with films about Ireland. It started way back when I was little. I read Leon Uris's Trinity and Redemption, which are a couple of novels that are centered around the start of the IRA in Ireland in the early 1900s. And I was that kind of sparked an interest in Irish history and Irish culture. So that kind of Brooklyn kind of reminded me of, hey, yeah, I do like this thing. And I remember when I read a bunch of stuff like that and wanted to go see it.
So it was just checking all your boxes, even though you really didn't know kind of what the film was like super about.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. So Elijah, same kind of question. What is it about Brooklyn that made you say, all right, let me stroll down to my movieplex? Were you just there already because you basically live there?
Not quite. No, this definitely checked a lot of my boxes. I love Saoirse Ronan. I just love saying the name Saoirse. What a cool name. I also love the name Eilish.
Eilish. Yeah.
I love these Gaelic Irish names. Mm-hmm. I've also spent 6 months in Ireland over three different summers, two mm-hmm. months each summer. I've been through Enniscorthy, where she comes from, and mm-hmm. spent some time in County Wexford. So I have that connection. I was a history major, so I love world-making movies.
When you say was a history major, as a fellow history major, we never really stopped being history majors, right?
That's true. That's true. I'll grant you that. So I love movies that take you to another world, take you to another place, do it well, sensitively, creatively. And this movie, I kind of knew as soon as I saw the trailer, was going to do that. In fact, you could almost make the case the movie is premised on almost a competition between two worlds or a tension between two worlds. Mm-hmm. And if that movie is going to fly, you've got to do the worlds well so you actually feel the tension. So I loved everything. I knew I would love this movie as soon as I saw the trailer.
Oh, so you went in with biased shades.
I went in knowing I'd be excited, and the more I think about it, the more excited I get.
That's great. See, for me, I felt like I didn't really recognize a whole lot about this film. I just knew that a lot of people that I typically respect their opinions on films, especially smaller films, started recommending this highly. It was getting really great reviews. It was written by, or it was adapted, I'm sorry, by Nick Hornby, who did About a Boy, Wild, and Education, all movies who I thought were pretty strong. And even though I didn't really recognize the director from anything, the cast looked solid. And so with recommendations, what I would look back now and say is probably fortuitousness, hindsight being 2020, I should have realized that this movie was going to be really good, if not great, because Donald Gleason's in it, and he is basically in every movie that apparently we needed to see this year. Yeah. Star Wars, Ex Machina, The Revenant, and then this movie. And then I think there was even something else that he was in.
The robot movie.
Yeah, Ex Machina. Yeah,
there's
There was something. Like I said, anyway, so I think there was something else that he was even in. So anything that was, I think, worth seeing this year, Donald Gleason was in. So that should have been a signifier, but I just didn't know it at the time. And so I kind of took some people's word for it, and I don't think I regretted it. I know the wife and I really enjoyed it.
That's an understatement, right? You don't think you regretted it?
Yeah, I don't think I regretted it.
Can you be more fluent?
I'm trying to, not show my entire hand quite yet.
Yeah.
So, well, I guess for various reasons we were drawn into the film. So, Blaine, what were your impressions after you left the film?
I loved it. Loved it. In fact, I saw that with my wife, Shannon, and I think we just sat there after it was over and we kind of gave each other a look. And it's that look that you give somebody when you know you just saw something really, really special and really great. I instantly wanted to see it again. I thought about it for, you know, a week, 2 weeks after I saw it for the first time. Eventually did get to go back and see it again. So I was immediately taken with it. In fact, I was taken with it probably, you know, halfway through the first act. I could tell that unless something went disastrously wrong, this was going to be a movie that ended up being, you know, on my top 10 list for best films of 2015.
Oh, I feel like I just let slip out what phrase you just used. It was like you were taken with it or something like that. What was it that caught you about it?
Yeah. So several things. One is just kind of the theme that immediately popped out at me that Elijah actually already mentioned, but then I'm sure we'll talk about a lot more, is this tension that Eilish's character feels like she's being pulled between these two different worlds, these two different identities, these two different people. That was something I found really fascinating. And I think one of the things I really liked about this movie is it's got this sort of deceptively simple appearance, right? Looks like a pretty simple story, a pretty traditional story. But I think there's really some profound stuff going on beneath the surface there, both formally and, you know, thematically.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's some really profound stuff. It was beautiful to look at, too. I mean, just so much fun to look at, like a delight to the eyes. The colors popped. The soundtrack is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the moment when the Irish guy gets up at the, you know, the, what would you call it, the soup kitchen type place,
mm-hmm.
and sings his song. That's one of those scenes that just kind of an iconic movie moment that that kind of stays with you. So a bunch of different things.
Mm. Elijah, kind of, how did you feel when you left the movie?
I was definitely inspired. I had a hop in my step and just a sense of accomplishment, like something had been conquered, like a victory had been won, like I'd seen something beautiful. I mean, the way you respond when something just kind of takes your breath away a little bit. I like what Blaine said about it was kind of deceptively simple. As I was reading through reviews, I found myself asking the question, what was so captivating about this? So several of the reviewers said that it had a fresh and new feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
For being a movie about something old, I mean, it takes place in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
What was fresh and new about this? I'd maybe throw that question out there later in the podcast, if not right now, but I've got some thoughts about what was fresh and new, but I think that question opens the door a little bit to what was so disarming and captivating about this movie.
Mm. So as we've either more or less described or danced around, the main thrust of this film sits with Eilish kind of starting in Ireland, immigrating to America to try to find a new life. And due to tragedy, she goes back to Ireland, kind of after she's finally starting to get her feet under her in Brooklyn. And her struggle between these two worlds. So I think it's important for us to kind of analyze what these two worlds are like, for us to really understand that theme of tension of these two worlds, like Blaine talked about. And so when Brooklyn gives us this main character who... Eilish, who is subdued and introverted. You know, she's not your typical, you know, 2015, I can't believe we finally have a strong, mm-hmm. fighting heroine.
Pop
kind
star.
Of. Yeah. She, you know, she, but she's still charming. Mm-hmm. She's still very sympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
She kind of get a glimpse of what both, like something we don't really get to do very often, which is, what would your full life look like if you had made this choice or this choice? Mm-hmm. I mean, typically from our our lives, we kind of go, I wonder what it would have been like if I made this other choice. I don't really know. She kind of sees what both those choices would be like in each of these different worlds. So, Elijah, how would you differentiate or exploration-itative her life in Brooklyn versus her life in Ireland? Like, what are some of the biggest differences?
Yeah, that's a great question. I actually wrote down a few descriptions, and I even asked myself the question when I walked out of the movie, is Brooklyn anti-country, anti-rural, and pro-urban, pro-city? Mm-hmm. Because I do think it presented, at the end of the day, a more positive view of Brooklyn than it did of Enniscorthy. She kind of left Enniscorthy with a little bit of disgust even, mm-hmm. and embraced Brooklyn. That was due to a personal interaction, but it kind of represented, I think, the city more broadly. So here's a few descriptions. I felt like Enniscorthy or Ireland, the country, more of a rural scene, I felt like it was insecure. The people there kept comparing themselves to, I'm sure we're not as good or as big as Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. It was kind of gossipy. It was kind of nosy. I saw what you did, or ladies peeking out the window. One lady even calls her into the shop and says, I'm gonna expose you as a fraud. And kind of controlling. It's like the mom's pulling strings and manipulating. The workers are pulling strings and manipulating. I didn't have a very, I don't feel like it was necessarily over the top, but I don't feel like it was positive. The city felt boisterous. It felt joyful. I mean, just all this giggling and laughing at the dinner table. It felt bubbly and it felt confident. There was just this swagger in the shop that she worked at, the department store. I remember her boss kind of gets on to her, and Ailish says, "I'm trying." Whatever it was, she wasn't doing wrong. And so her boss says, "What, do you try to put your panties on?" Like, no, you don't. You do the job. Kind of grow up, little girl. And so there was just this huge contrast between the insecurity and the kind of nosy, controlling nature of the country, and then this freewheeling, kind of wide open, confident, joyful nature of the city in Brooklyn.
Mm. So, Blaine, would your descriptors of both those places be similar, or did you see some other traits of both these lives that she was kind of presented with?
Yeah, no, definitely. I agree with a lot of that. In fact, I wrote a piece that's still forthcoming on Brooklyn, and I talked a lot about this, and I talked about some of the filmmaking techniques and the formal elements that are used in Brooklyn to kind of communicate some of those same ideas. If you look at like the very first shot in Brooklyn, it's of a dark alleyway in Ireland, right? It's the neighborhood that Ailish lives in, and it's just dark and dingy. And for a movie that's so bright, otherwise, the shots like that really stand out, right? And I think that kind of shot just sets us up to sort of identify and understand Ailish's emotional state and her emotional sort of understanding of her homeland at that time. So, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I thought you were done.
You can go ahead. You can ask another question.
Well, I was going to add that I was reading some of the trivia or interesting facts about Brooklyn, wherever it was that I was reading it, and it was the director talking about how he used three distinct styles to film the film, I guess, and how there's lots of, you know, very narrow kind of confining shots, not a lot of really great color being used when she's first in Ireland, and then, you know, Brooklyn, almost, you know, basically what Elijah's saying, the colors that they use are very like kind of boisterous, and it almost they're bright, you know, it's fun, if you know, fun can be a color. And then he actually describes, and this is where I might differ a little in how I see the two places, because I would definitely 100% agree with Elijah how you kind of laid out basically her home in Ireland and Brooklyn, if we're comparing Act 1 and Act 2. But I think if we look at Act 3, I think while some of that stuff is still there, like the director talks about how he makes it almost like fantastical, like everything's very, I think he used the word dreamy, almost like it's, you know, it's too beautiful to exist, you know.
Which place is this?
This is when she's back in Ireland. She's back in Ireland.
Okay, yeah.
You know, like they go down to the beach and it's peaceful. And a word that you didn't use, and I think you didn't use it intentionally, was that I would have used the word safe. Whereas I would contrast that against Brooklyn, which I would say was unsure, was risky. I mean, there was the positive sides of it. It was exhilarating, you know, it could be fun. It could be, rewarding, but there was no certainty. There's very transition, you know, a city in transition. But there's stability. There's, assurance, you know, there is comfort in going back to a place that is physically beautiful, because I think they intentionally made it a much more beautiful place to be. Like, you know, Blaine, you talked about how one of the first shots is the alley shot, right?
Yeah.
And it's dark and dank. Yep. And like, Eilish has to get out of here. Like, there, like, no one is like, she really should stick around in this really terrible job. This woman who's hateful and, you know, this place that's dark and sad. But when she goes back, I mean, she's having like lunch with Jim Farrell's parents on this beautiful countryside, and you know, the sunlight and the green grass, or where they're swimming, or they're going to the club, and it's a completely different lifestyle that is safe and I think alluring, which I think adds to the tension in the film. And I would add that to the two worlds that she's in. Did you want to add anything else to that, Blaine?
No, I mean, I think that's a really good point. And I think that's the thing. One of the things this film does really well is it's actually, like I said, it looks deceptively simple, but it's actually a really nuanced picture of these sort of tensions that mark, you know, its protagonist's life. And I think, I mean, if we keep going back to that word tension, I think that's a key word. In the piece that I wrote on this, I use the word liminality a lot, which is like, a transitory state, right? She's not in one place or another. She's somewhere in between, which is actually my favorite line in the film when she's writing a letter back to her sister, I believe.
Yeah, Rose.
She says, it used to be that, you know, I wanted to be away from Ireland in Brooklyn. And now my heart is somewhere in between. It's halfway across the sea. And I think that really sums up the entire movie really well in one line. It's also interesting if you can look at what Eilish wears throughout the film. I think that's really, really significant in highlighting all of these tensions that she's experiencing. Early on, even though she clearly wants to get out of Ireland, in the entire first act, she's almost exclusively in green, almost exclusively. A dark green. Maybe some white. There's a time when she wears some orange too. So she's wearing the colors of the Irish flag, which is really interesting. And the Irish flag itself was a symbol of peace being made between two opposing forces. So there's a lot of visual symbolism going on there. In the second act, when she starts to meet Tony and things, you start seeing her in brighter colors, yellows and blues. Even her makeup changes, where her features are you know, more highlighted. My wife pointed that out. I don't notice things like that.
I totally don't notice. Yeah.
but it's super cool that that's one of the techniques they use to kind of communicate all of these tensions she's feeling when she goes back to Ireland. And she, you know, you wonder if she is gonna, if she's gonna fall in love with Jim Farrell and stay there and abandon Tony. Even though that's how she's acting, and that's kind of what we're afraid of, she's wearing American colors, you know, air quotes American colors.
Yeah.
She's wearing colors that she didn't wear at the beginning of the film. So there's still tension there the entire time. She's in between two worlds. And I think for us as Christians, that's a really, it's a really, really illuminating film, because that's exactly what we are as Christians, right? I mean, we recognize that Christ has come. He's inaugurated the kingdom. We're citizens of his kingdom. We're his servants. We're his followers. At the same time, we're here on this earth, and we're doing good and doing work here on this earth. I mean, the Apostle Paul said, you know, I long to die and be with the Lord, because that's much better, but I'm here. You know, I'm here on earth serving right now. So anyways, that was a long rant, but, I think that's a really good point.
That's really, really good. Two thoughts, one going back to the safe versus risky, or the tension or the contrast. I think two other areas you see that in is the two beach scenes. So you have Coney Island beach scene, crowded, kind of boisterous, a lot of people milling around. And then you have the Ireland beach scene. I think you used the word quiet, peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a contrast there. And then you also have a contrast between the two homes. So when Jim Ferrell shows her home, it's the home that his parents built that he's going to inherit. When Tony shows her a home, it's an empty field that they're just standing outside the city. Just kind of nothing here, but I have a dream. Kind of, would you do this with me? So I really resonate with that. I love what you're saying, Blaine, about this in between, the liminality. What this movie really made me think of in those terms concretely was the whole immigrant experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me, probably more than any other movie I've seen in recent memory, think of what it would be to be an immigrant. Let's just pick a country, Germany, China, Nigeria, I mean, whatever country you want it to be. And I began to imagine what it would be like to leave my American citizenship behind, to forget my native language, to forget friends and family, to, let's say, no longer have a hamburger again, to lose a lot of the comforts, a lot of the stories, to basically be uprooted from my sense of place that I currently have.
An identity to a great degree.
Losing my identity. And why would a person do this? I think it introduces this theme of hope. You go somewhere in hope of a better life. But I also think, to your point, Blaine, that it's a great, the immigration experience is a great window. In fact, I'm going to preach on this Sunday. I'm so excited about this. I'm preaching on Jesus's baptism and what it means to be baptized into Christ, Luke 3. And I now see immigration as the process of the immigration experience as a very helpful image of what it means to kind of live out your baptism. Like, you're leaving these things behind. You're going to forget these certain things and die to these certain things, but then you're going to learn and see new things created, a new name, a new identity, a new sense of place. And I feel like immigrants understand that better than almost anybody. And I feel like it's very hard for us to understand that as kind of well-established citizens of the country that everybody wants to go to, roughly speaking, in terms of the American dream. It's almost like we need to reverse engineer the immigration experience in order to understand the gospel, if I could be even that bold.
Well, I would say if you take that one step further and kind of like Blaine did, apply it to the Christian life, I would say that the reason that you could argue that there's not a lot of life in the American Christian life is because not only is America the country that people want to come to, but America is, I would say at least 2/3 of it is pretty friendly to cultural Christianity. So there's, you're not having from the time you're born to the time you die.
Right.
Most people, if you never really move too far away from where you were born, you never have to really learn your faith in a new setting.
Right.
You never have to leave what you're comfortable with and kind of wrestle with what does it mean to be a follower of Christ when maybe things aren't easy or assumed.
Absolutely. And I mean, just think of the Old Testament in particular, how much of the story of the people of God is an immigration, either voluntary or forced experience. So Abraham, leave your land and go. Okay, I'll leave my land and go. And so that's voluntary. But Joseph and Jacob and his brothers ends up being involuntary because they're slaves in Egypt, and then Babylonian exile. So just over and over again, the people lost in the desert, in the wilderness, Book of Numbers. So just so much going on with this loss of home, loss of identity, which raises the question, where does my identity really come from? Where is my home? Mm-hmm. This most powerful line I thought in the movie is, home is home. It was in the trailer. Tony says this when he's afraid of Eilish going back to Ireland. So I don't want you to go. Why is that? Because home is home. Like, I'm not sure where you've really landed. Yeah. And I don't want you to be. So I think it maybe that would take us back into the movie. It's a really cool rabbit trail into the Christian life. But what does reestablish Eilish's identity? What does she find that makes her feel, that makes her call America home, Brooklyn home?
You mean after she goes back?
Yeah, after she goes back, or even the first leg of the journey there. I think there are specific markers, specific things that happen to her that move her along the continuum to say, no, this is home now. So maybe I'd throw that question out to you guys. What do you think happens in the movie, or what does the director use to transform Eilish from an Irish girl to an American girl in terms of calling it home?
Well, one of the things that's really cool is there are a lot of mirroring scenes or mirror images. So early on, when Eilish first comes to America, you know, she feels very isolated, very alone. There's an image of her sitting at a diner, staring at herself, or staring into a mirror. And that shot is kind of, you know, of the mirror and her reflection in it. And there's a very similar scene when she goes back to Ireland. There's also, I mean, there's obviously two beach scenes, you know, when she's with Tony, and then when she's with Jim. And I think those sort of mirror scenes, not only do they remind us that, hey, this has happened before, don't forget about Tony back home, it also, you know, these similarities are reminding her. I mean, that happens in real life. Like, you go through a circumstance and you're like, oh, that just made me remember, you know, of something that happened, you know, 15, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So that there's the mirror scene, there's the beach scene, and then there's the dinner scene where when it happens in America, she's eating with Tony and, you know, she's kind of been alone, hadn't had a lot of people to talk to. And Tony says, tell me about accounting. I don't know anything about it. And it turns out she talks for almost the entire meal. Tony's eaten all of his food and she's still sitting there talking. Well, that happens back in Ireland, except this time it's Jim talking and she's listening.
Oh, that's good.
So I think a lot of those mirror scenes kind of start to push her that way.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to the mean old lady.
Well, and I would throw this out there, and it might not be exactly what you're looking for, Elijah, but it had to do with one of the questions I was eventually going to ask you guys. But I think there's a specific role that, surprisingly, the church plays.
Or
however you want to define it, Christianity or Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like not only was it wasn't like she didn't go and like we saw her at mass every week or anything like that, but we saw the role of not only her Irish heritage, but something that Italians and the Irish would have both been able to share, Catholicism, and this Father Flood played very a really good word for likably, by Jim Broadbent, just kind of helping her out, just being like, I'll set you up with a job, I'll give you some counsel, I'll help you pay for your first year of classes. Like, he does things that he doesn't expect to be paid back, simply because he cares about someone who he's never met up until that point. He only has the connection, I think, through Rose.
Well, he sponsored her to come over.
Yeah.
So he'd already invested in her before he'd even met her. Yeah, the church stood out to me as well. I think a romantic interest, a boy, helps create the sense of home. Like, oh, somebody's interested in me, somebody's pursuing me. I think the job plays a significant role. The thing that, as I reflected on this question, that surprised me was how many scenes were filmed around the boarding house dinner table. I mean, it was almost every night, the end of the day, this reoccurring pattern. We're at the dinner table with head lady. I can't remember her name.
You know how to pronounce it, Blaine?
I can't remember.
Yeah, it's Miss Keogh.
Miss Keogh.
Yeah, it's like K-E-O-G-H. So
yeah.
I mean, I would almost go so far as to say it seemed like a quarter of the movie was filmed around a dinner table.
Yeah.
And I think that's significant. And I think you see, I haven't thought through the contrast, but I think you see more friendly dinner table scenes in America than you probably do in Brooklyn. I think you alluded to that, Blaine, with Jim doing most of the talking, but even the dinner scene around Tony's dinner table where she's trying to learn how to eat spaghetti, I think is part of the coming home experience, or the creating of a home experience. Yeah. So I loved how it used really just everyday aspects of life, the community of faith, the work environment, the dinner table to create a sense of home.
Mm. Yeah. Well, and I think, one of the things I love, I think this movie ends on the perfect note at the perfect time, because it is a sentimental film. It's a romantic movie, but at the same time, it sort of avoids being just overly and vapidly sentimental, like a lot of, like, it's not a Nicholas Sparks movie. Okay?
Amen.
Yes.
Rejoicing.
It ends at the right time so that it's just not overly sweet or overly sentimental. You still get that lingering sense of she still has some Irish identity. Like, she's not totally abandoning this. Mm-hmm. She's, like, there's always going to be some sort of tension that marks her life. And I think that's good. I think that's true to reality. I think that reflects life accurately. We never fully feel totally at home.
Yeah.
And you know, the secret that makes what you said so true, I think, is really Saoirse Ronan. I doubt whether any other actress could have pulled off what she pulled off. Not saccharine, not sentimental, floozy-ish. I think the way she did it, more than anything else that stood out to me anyway, was just her eyes.
Yeah.
I wrote down the shift that I saw happen in her eyes throughout the movie. So at the beginning, her eyes are the shy, timid stranger, and then her eyes become this pool of sadness when she grieves the loss of Ireland. Then they begin to come a little bit more confident. Then they eventually become joyful and even playful. So just with her eyes, I mean, what a minimalist actress can do with her eyes is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That she led a very delicate and thoughtful transition of leading you on this emotional trail of a thoughtful immigration experience, a heart-moving immigration experience without it being over the top.
Yeah.
And what a timely movie, too. I mean, with all of the immigration issues that are being talked about, not to turn this into a political podcast, but with all the immigration issues that are being discussed, it seems like a really timely movie for an American audience. I remember I saw it around the time when Governor Abbott here in Texas issued the order that we weren't going to allow Syrian refugees in. So I think this movie, you know, culturally raises some questions that need to be addressed and need to be talked about.
Mm-hmm. Well, not only that, and I don't remember which review said it, it's not my own words, so I'm trying to give credit to whoever it was that I can't remember. But they basically cited this movie as a movie that, oddly enough, for being about a specific person from a specific country going to a specific place in a very specific decade, like, there's no doubt that this is the 1950s, this movie seems almost like it could be at any time. Like, it's almost timeless, sort of, because it's a story that we have seen throughout history. As Elijah pointed out, we see immigration in the Bible. You know, there's people who are moving from one place to another, forced or sometimes voluntarily, from the beginning of history, and we see this now. So even though this is a story about a specific person, it's told in such a beautiful and simple way, with such innocence, that it's relatable. And I think I just really, really loved what Elijah Davidson wrote about it in his review, when he said, Brooklyn is a movie for anyone who has ever, well, actually, let me emphasize some things. Brooklyn is a movie for anyone who has ever wondered what it means to call a place home. For anyone who has struggled to reconcile their identity when it's tied to more than one place and group of people. For anyone who has ever longed to be true to everyone all at once while still being true to her or himself. And I think that kind of circles us back a little bit to the Christian life conversation, because I think that's why this is timeless, because I think movies that can be simple and still connect with us. I mean, like I said, there weren't any explosions in this movie. There wasn't like overly melodramatic romance. There wasn't like some kind of, you know, fire at the plant that maimed a husband. Yeah. You know, like it didn't need any of that, because I think it was telling a simple truth that all of us wrestle with. We wrestle with it whether we're Christian or not, because whether I was a Christian or not, I always felt the struggle when I left home. Right. And I went to college, and back home, you know, there was a certain type of culture. Mm-hmm. There was a certain type of kind of country, kind of conservative America culture that I didn't really fit in with, despite having a huge family. All like I was like the, you know, the black sheep almost. And when I went to college, I found lots of people that I really connected with in this life, but I could never escape who I really was. I was trying to be, you know, all to all while still trying to be myself. And I did I have lots of found family, but it made me ask, where do I want to be? Because as much as I enjoy being in the heart of a city, having people at our house, you know, visiting with friends, sharing meals, working for the good of like a greater moving community, there are times when I can go back home and I can sit on my mom's porch and I can look over the hay field that doesn't end until I see the sun setting, and I can say, and I say, maybe I just want to be here, you know? And it feels like I'm wrestling with something very similar, because I would probably never do what God wants me to do living where I'm from, but it's safe. And at times it's beautiful and it's very comforting. And there's a lot more risk and it costs a lot more. The, you know, like the house that we can buy in the city, I could buy a house almost three times the size with lots of land, you know, out in the country. So there's lots more risk being here. I have to have a certain type of job. I have to spend so many hours doing X, Y, or Z. And there's that tension.
I think you're really on. You mentioned a second ago, there's no explosions. There's no melodrama. There's no this. I think that's true, but I think there's something even deeper going on here. And the way I would highlight it, I would say this movie, the closest movie that I think can think of that parallels Brooklyn is the movie The Martian. And here's what I mean by that. When people walked out of The Martian, they were almost shocked by how joyful and robust and playful and confident of a movie it was. Like, man, he was up there, his life was on the line, but he was just having a good time. Like, one reviewer even called it good old-fashioned American can-do-ism. And I think another reviewer wrote, the AP reviewer wrote a very similar thing about Brooklyn. She basically said, we've been trained to expect bad things to happen in movies, especially bad things to immigrants. She didn't get abused by her boyfriend. She didn't get taken advantage of by the church. She didn't she didn't get beat up. She didn't get spit on. She didn't end
up. She made good grades. She made good. She
got, like, it was just a, which, the irony of it is this. I think this used to be the kind of movie, the feel good movie, the kind of success story movie, or the you work hard and kind of good things happen movie. I think probably used to be a lot more common, which to me shows kind of how cynical we've become as a culture, that we're shocked when a genuine, hardworking, kind of honest, feel-good movie actually, it knocks us off of our feet, because we're used to expecting bad things to happen. We've learned to become kind of cynical. And so I think it's deeper than just no explosions. I think it's actually what I would call a return to a romantic portrayal of life.
Mm.
And I think it captivated people because it's so foreign to how we think now.
Well, that was most of the questions that I had. And I think that's a great point, but I wanted to give you guys a chance to bring up anything else before we kind of started winding it down. Blaine, did you have anything else that you really wanted to kind of speak to?
I mean, I would just say as much, and as much as we made a point of sort of nerding out about some of the things that that go on, I know I can be especially bad about that, especially since I've written on this recently. I don't want any of that to in any way to discourage people from going to see this, thinking, oh, you know, I'm going to go see an art house film or something, you know, really odd or quirky. Like, you need to go see this movie. It is it's a devastating movie, and as much as it's hopeful, it's devastating in a good way. I mean, I wept in the movie, and I don't do that often. I mean that it still has stuck with me. I mean, I think about it every week, at least. Still, I mean, it's one of those movies that just won't let you go, and that's a good thing. We need more things like that, and we need the kind of realistic optimism that it offers.
That's a great word. There's one other thing that I think was huge in this movie, and I would highlight it by quoting David Brooks' description of Pope Francis. David Brooks, New York Times columnist, is writing about Pope Francis, basically asking the question, what is it about Pope Francis that just got everybody like kind of goo-goo-eyed, so excited, so impressed. Even if you don't like him or you don't like the Catholic Church or whatever, people will say, well, I still like Pope Francis. And David Brooks' synopsis was that Pope Francis is a personalist. I don't know if he made that word up or not. I don't know if David Brooks made that word up, but essentially what he meant was Pope Francis walks into a crowd of whatever, a million people or thousands of people, and he goes up to one person who has a diseased face and he kisses that one person on the head. In other words, he's honed into the personal interaction of daily life, and he does it over and over. He washes a prisoner's feet. He feeds a person who's in need of food. Over and over again, he lives out this kind of personalist life of focusing on the individual.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like this movie did something very similar with Eilish. Like, this was very much a personalist movie. You unapologetically saw the world through her eyes. And we've talked about this contrast or this tension between Ireland and Brooklyn. I think another contrast that is maybe even just as powerful but more subtle is the contrast between Eilish and, in particular, all the other women that are around her. You see it happen over and over again with the bubbly, kind of giddy girls who want to go get a boy, and they think working in the church volunteer food kitchen is boring. Lame. But there's Eilish. The next scene, she's in the food kitchen with her little hat on serving food. You've got this kind of bossy, rowdy house mom there at the boarding house who's kind of telling everybody what to do. And then you've got Eilish, who's just kind of quiet and composed and very, very thoughtful. You've got the nerdy kind of new girl that came over from Ireland who's kind of geeky. And you would think, oh, she's going to be best friends with Eilish because Eilish is an introvert and maybe she's not the coolest person. But then Eilish ends up even contrasting to this girl. So I just think over and over again, you see Eilish growing in contrast to the people around her. And I think that's another tension that highlights this personal investment in Eilish.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I thought she was this, but no, she's not, because she just contrasted to what I thought she was. And I think that's a filmmaking technique, I guess you could say. I wouldn't know the technical phrase like you would, Blaine, but a way that Eilish constantly surprises us in a similar way that Jesus constantly surprises the crowds. Like, oh my goodness, he even does this, or oh my goodness, the winds and the waves obey him, kind of thing. I feel like a similar dynamic is going on with Eilish. Like, wow, she's even more surprising than I thought she was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point. And both you and Mikey are kind of touching on thing. I think Mikey, you mentioned Father Flood. such a fantastic portrayal of a church leader.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, amazing. And there's almost something very Jobian about Father Flood and the way he treats Ailish. So, you know, Job has his friends come to him, his three friends, and Job is going through all this suffering, and his friends are just trying to correct his theology. And they're like, you know, you either did this wrong, or you're thinking about this wrong. Or, you know, if you thought right about these things, or you didn't do something, then things would be okay. Of course, God comes in and silences, and you know, silences that at the end. But Father Flood is kind of the opposite of that, right? He's there. He's weeping with those who weep, right? Like, he doesn't tell Ailish when she's, you know, when she's worried about the loss of her family member, or when she's suffering, like, well, you know, if you just thought about it like this, or if you just weren't so dumb, or stop being such a crybaby. He's just there. He comforts her. He puts his hand on her, and you know, like, he cares for her in a real tangible sort of way. And I just think it's such a wonderful and charitable depiction of clergy.
Mm-hmm.
Really encouraging.
Well, it's like the only good clergy we've gotten to see for the past couple of years are all Irish clergy, Irish Catholics.
Right. And then I saw Spotlight the next week. So.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. What a contrast.
Well,
and it does go to show that even non-Christian movie reviewers can... I mean, it puts to rest the idea that that secular movie reviewers are going to hate everything Christian. Like,
yeah.
they love this movie. Mm-hmm. And so there's more going on than just, I hate everything Christian. Sure, maybe there's a bias there, but even if there is a bias, people can still be taken by a winsome portrayal of the body of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, with that, we will... kind of, I guess, head towards the end, which we do by, after gushing over this film, trying to find something that maybe didn't sit with us right. And Blaine, based on some of our personal like offline conversations, I find it hard to believe that you have anything that you could critique about this movie, but if there is, I'd love to hear it.
I mean, I know it's not a perfect film, right? I know it's not like there's nothing wrong with it. I usually try to think of these beforehand, but honestly, I'm so, like I said, I'm so taken with this movie. I don't think I can give you anything substantial just off the top of my head like this, acknowledging that it's not necessarily perfect.
Mm. Well, that's fine. I didn't expect much from you anyway. But Elijah, is there anything that you wanted to...
No, I would have a hard time thinking of that. I mean, if I was to try to highlight one thing, like, what is the likelihood that a guy in America is going to know the relative of somebody in Ireland who just happened mm-hmm. to meet her at the train station when she was getting married, and then talking about marriage,
mm-hmm. Just at the right time.
Yeah, just at the right time that the shop owner knows that calls her on the carpet in the upstairs above the shop.
Well, in 1950s Brooklyn, that's probably very common. All the immigrants.
Yeah, I mean,
in.
How do you do that without texting or cell phone videos? I mean, how do we know this was real? Yeah, but I mean, that was it had to happen for the plot to advance the mm-hmm. way it did. And I mean, you're already so in love with the movie that you don't hold that against it. But
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Well, so I'll bring up two things. One's a personal thing, and one I think is a great observation again that Elijah Davidson made. Which, I mean, his review will be in the show notes. The thing for me personally is that anytime there is a choice between two seemingly pretty good options, I always have this inner thing that defaults back to the Russell Crowe film, A Good Year, when the general idea of the film was that he had a pick between like making tons of money and living like in Manhattan. With a good job, or like I think inheriting like some vineyards in like Italy or mm-hmm. France or something. And you know, I was like, oh, your life is so tough, which one are you gonna make? Like that, the movies that make person choose between a wonderful thing and a wonderful thing usually bring out my cynicism, speaking of cynical Americans. There was part of me that couldn't shake that, even though when I think about it longer I realized that this movie nuanced it a little bit more, where it wasn't just like good situation or good situation. Like, it really was a hard decision. And both with their positives and minuses, and not just like glossy, amazing, glossy, amazing. But it helped me, what made me reflect a little bit on the fact that for some reason, I think probably, and that's why I admit that, because it's at the back of my mind, the more and more confident that Eilish became, the less and less I was on board with her character. Hmm. I was really on board with her character at the beginning, like hoping she overcame. But once she started kind of calling the shots, it was harder to be on board with her. Hmm. But like I said, I think that's just because I'm reading too much into this film from cynicism I have from other films.
Well, and along those lines, what struck me is she actually lost confidence in Ireland. Like, mm-hmm. she kind of just got sucked along, and you started to believe, like, she's going to get stuck here. Like, mm-hmm. she's not going to get out of that accounting job at mm-hmm. the seamstress shop or whatever she was doing there. She's going to just marry this guy. Everybody. And so it took this shocking moment of, I saw what you did. Yeah. I know you're a liar. Like, it took that. It was almost like she woke back up again mm-hmm. and rediscovered her confidence. So I think your point is a good one. She did grow in confidence, but in the third act, it seemed like it called her confidence back into question mm-hmm. When she went back to Ireland.
Well, and I think that would lead to what I want to mention on behalf of Elijah Davidson. He said one of his few quibbles with the film was the fact that for a film that seemed to kind of stress like the authenticity of the time and kind of the emotions and feeling of what would have been going on in an immigrant's life, or the struggles or the joys that they could have, there was like maybe a misunderstanding of what marriage would have meant to mm-hmm. 1950s like Irish or mm-hmm. you know, Catholic culture, mm-hmm. Where it would have been something that would not have been like
easily forgotten.
Yeah, wait, easily forgotten or easily gone into.
Right.
So if they did make that commitment, that wouldn't have been something that she would not have been tempted back in Ireland. It would have mm-hmm. been like, well, this is the way it is. And, mm-hmm. you know, we're Catholic, so yeah, this yeah. isn't like yeah. I could forget about it or I could sweep it under the rug. Mm-hmm. It was actually a lot more important to them culturally. So of the things that we could complain about. Mm-hmm. So then I turned this around. And we end, hopefully, much like we've been going most of the mm-hmm. podcast, which is kind of gushing about the goodness of the simplicity of this film. Mm-hmm. And so, Blame, what did you like, man? What was your favorite stuff?
I love the song in the soup kitchen mm-hmm. on Christmas. I'm a sucker for that. So, great, just great moment.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Elijah?
Yeah, I would probably go to a similar moment in that same scene where all these old guys are walking in with gray hair and their hats and kind of hunched over, bent backs. And Eilish looks at the priest and says, "Who are these people?" And the priest says, "These are the people that built, Brooklyn, or built yeah. New York City, that built the bridges, built the tunnels, built the roads." Yeah. And so you have kind of this... It was the one time in the movie where I felt like they went macro with the immigration mm-hmm. experience. Like, everything else was personalist, small, honed in on Eilish. But it was the one time where it pulled back the lens more broadly mm-hmm. and said, here's a generation of immigrants who've all had a similar experience to Eilish. So I like the multi-generational nature of that scene. I love that she was engaging with that scene by serving them. Mm-hmm. And I love the song just as you did, Blaine.
Yeah. Well, I think apparently we're all on the same page here, because my favorite part was a combination of the song and that scene, because yeah. it hits really hard when they kind of take the time in a very non-pushy kind of way to remind you that these people who are probably going to starve or die are the people who built New York, mm-hmm. you know, or America mm-hmm. to a greater degree. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, like I said, they could have really tried to make that like a thing that they were trying to pound, mm-hmm. but they did it in such a way that really just added to the story.
It did, yeah.
It added to the joy we got from the success of Eilish's story. Mm-hmm. And I would say, when I was trying to think of a favorite moment, even though I really enjoyed the film, it was hard to pick something that I really enjoyed. And I think it's because there's not really, like I said, there's super exciting moments. You know, there's not like the over-dramatized love reunion mm-hmm. or, you know, accident or overcoming necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's just a really great feeling you get after having completed the film mm-hmm. and realizing that, I guess, like you described in the very beginning, Elijah, that you felt like you watched something good happen, mm-hmm. you know? So it was hard to pick a favorite moment mm-hmm. outside of, you know, I mean, the song was so good. Mm-hmm. It's easy to gravitate towards. Well, this is the chance where I would let you guys maybe throw out a final thought, along with letting people know how they can follow your other work or the other things that you're doing. So, Blaine, last thoughts and how people can get a hold of you.
Last thought, go see the movie. That's Shocker. It. You got to go see it. You can find me writing reviews and doing podcasts, things like that, at Real World Theology. If you want to find me on Twitter, you can follow me at @DEPT_of_tourism. Because I like to make that as hard as possible. like I said, I wrote a piece on Brooklyn that is going to be forthcoming, so you'll see more about that in the future. It may be
out by the time this is out, maybe?
Maybe, yeah.
Okay. Elijah, same thing? Final thought?
No, I think I've shared everything that I wanted to. How you can find me, I am the executive pastor on staff at Church of the Redeemer, so you can visit our website if you want to listen to a sermon. That I've preached there at redeemergso.org. You can find my email address on there or look me up on Facebook. I do some posting on there every now and then. Love thinking out loud about culture and Christ and just kind of what's happening in the world.
Well, and I would kind of echo the sentiment of you should probably see this movie.
Absolutely.
Like I said, I don't necessarily know when this podcast is going to air, but we're recording it in early January. And I'm hoping that in 2 weeks or so, we're going to hear that this movie was recognized for something mm-hmm. by the Academy. It would kind of be a shame if it wasn't. Mm-hmm. So, again, hopefully by the time that you guys are listening to this, you are listening to it because you're wondering why it might have been nominated for XYZ Award. And if not, then travesty. You're listening to it because we're telling you it should have been. Mm-hmm. So... with that, follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. Follow the show at Real World Theo. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher or Feedburner, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And as always, we are so thankful for the time that our guests have taken to be a part of the show. Elijah, Blaine, make sure you follow them. I'll have all their stuff, ways of contacting them up in the show notes. So check that out. Thank you so much for taking the time to make us a part of your week. Continue to make us a part of your week or your month or whatever by joining our Facebook discussion group where we're just chatting about all kinds of movie news and the movies that we review. And until our next episode, please remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
Did you know the word fun does not exist in Russian?
I did.
It blew my mind when I learned that. Like, they have no word for the word fun.
They just substitute the word vodka. Sense.
Do I?
They just substitute the word vodka.
No, they substitute the word world domination. I like it. I've actually made up a new word for you. It hit me in the car on the way over. I'm going to coin the phrase critiquery.
Critiquery?
That we are about to engage in movie critiquery.
I'm hoping that it's not just critiquery. I'm hoping that it's explorative.
Tinkery. It's got to have eekery in it. That's what I'm on about right now. I'm excited about eekery.
We can't have like an Asian...